but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
We're about 24 hours away from the ESPN honks going full bore, telling us how great the SEC is. College football playoff rankings reveal will no doubt include some talk about how many teams and how many potential three-loss teams the SEC should get into the playoff. Where do you stand on three-loss teams in general? Because I can see a scenario, just bear with me here, where Texas, who just got boat raced by Georgia, could go on and potentially beat Texas A&M. Let's just throw that out there. Let's just say Texas finds a way to beat Texas A&M. It's not unthinkable. I'd bet against it. But let's just say Texas pulls that off, because they become the ultimate three-loss candidate in the college football playoff. They would have a win over undefeated Texas A&M. They would have a win over Oklahoma, which just beat Alabama, and they'd had a win over Vanderbilt. Do the wins matter or do the losses matter? Which matters more if they both matter? Three losses looms large, but it wasn't just a loss to Georgia. Texas lost by 25 points on Saturday. Blowout loss. Remember when Oregon lost that way to Georgia, 49-3, that opening game, and everyone kept saying, well, if it's Oregon's only loss, could they potentially get in? You go, no, the playoff can't have that. It was a four-team playoff at the time. But Texas got beat respectably by Ohio State. Ohio State got them by 7. And then they lost to Florida. You know, the Florida loss is a bad loss. The Georgia loss is a bad margin of victory loss. If you're on the committee, a hypothetical 9-3 Texas with victories over Oklahoma and Texas A&M and Vanderbilt, are they the ultimate three-loss team that gets in from the SEC? 503-417-7575. You tell me what we do with these three-loss teams. The argument can be made and has been made that the 12 most deserving teams should be in the playoff. And there are some who will go to the mattresses trying to argue that. Paul Feinbaum going on ESPN and saying no group of five team deserves to be in the playoff. Those are valuable spots. They should go to more deserving teams that are in third place or fourth place in some of these power conferences. Others will argue, no, just like the NCAA tournament, you win your conference and you are in one of the five highest ranked conference champions, you're automatically in. Even if it's the ACC and people don't respect it, you win that conference, you're in. You win the highest ranked group of five conference, you're in. You win the Big 12, you're in. Well, where do you stand on all of that? Because I think that will, in the next 2 or 3 years, become an increasing debate. I was down in New World Pac-12 country on Saturday. I got to see San Diego State beat Boise State. 17-7 was the final. The forward pass was not part of that game. It rained. People in Southern California freaked out. I wrote all about it at johncanzano.com. But San Diego State getting ready to become part of the New World Pac-12. And one of the things that came up in my conversations with the athletic directors of both San Diego State and Boise State was that the Pac-12 more or less supports the notion of keeping the playoff at 12 teams. What's that you say? Why keep it at 12? Well, San Diego State's AD, J.D. Wicker, in particular, told me that in a 16-team playoff, you have the potential for one to play 16. No buys. You just get right at it. 16-team playoff. He says, I think 16 is going to have a really hard time beating number one. But in a 12-team playoff where 5 is playing 12 and there are first-round byes, he says, I could see some 12s pulling off that upset. In fact, you know, if we throw the seeding out from last year, Arizona State had Texas on the ropes. Arizona State was very good, and Arizona State wouldn't have been one of the top four seeds had they not been under the old seeding format. That would have been an ideal sort of situation. Boise State last year got, you know, blown off the field by Penn State. Do you support staying at 12 or expanding to 16? Are you good with what we have going on right now? Or do we need all of these teams in? Because Texas would be in. Miami would be in without a question. You'd have, you know, the potential in the Big 12 to have both Utah and BYU get in addition to Texas Tech if you go to a 16-team playoff. Is more merrier? 503-417-7575. And what did we learn this last weekend? Because, you know, Alabama's 8-2 and Oklahoma's 8-2. I guess either one of those teams could become part of a three-loss should they get in debate. But Alabama's two losses, again, I'm focusing on the losses, not the wins. Alabama's two losses are by a total of only 4 points to Miami and to Texas A&M. Those are pretty good losses. Oklahoma's two losses to Texas and Ole Miss, not nearly as close. And in fact, you know, that loss to Texas doesn't look all that great. Alabama still has Auburn in a rivalry game. You know, weird things could happen there in the Iron Bowl. Oklahoma plays unranked Missouri and unranked LSU, both at home. I think Oklahoma's going to be there at 10-2 and probably get into the playoff. But the biggest loser, if the SEC somehow sneaks a three-loss team into the playoff, is probably the ACC, where Miami, Georgia Tech, and Virginia are all trying to fight to get in, or the Big 12, where BYU and Utah would be left on the bubble. I expect you're going to hear from the ACC and Big 12 commissioners this week, who will be lobbying and pandering. And speaking of lobbying and pandering, here comes Kirk Herbstreit with a rant about the SEC.
You start adding it up, A&M, Georgia, Ole Miss, Bama would be the fourth, potentially fifth team in these rankings for the SEC. So we're not trying to, these idiots to say, how much do people pay you to say this? Like, we're talking about the sport. We're talking about what we care about. I don't give a about the SEC. I give a about where are they going to come? How are they going to find these 12 teams? Where are they going to, how are they going to split these hairs at 11, 12, 13, 14? It's fascinating to me. I don't really care who they put in. Put Miami in. I don't care. I don't care if you put six group of five teams in. Do whatever you want to do. I'm just saying, based on what the Sagarin ratings, the AP, the coaches poll, everybody recognizes the depth and the challenge of the SEC. You can hate that. You can make fun of that. Do whatever the hell you want with that. That's the reality of the sport. That's the reality of the world. You can live in fake world. Do whatever the you want to do as far as I'm concerned. But the reality is this sport, we're trying to get the best 12 teams in. And how we get there, I got no idea.
Got no idea, Herbie. I would ask Herbie to think back to the 2023 NCAA tournament and explain to us how a Mountain West Conference team, San Diego State, got to the national championship game under a 12-team format where, heck, we're just trying to get the best 12 teams and isn't the best conference the SEC. That was said at the time about the college basketball world. Oh, the SEC's got the best teams. You know, you ended up with a UConn versus San Diego State national final.
The other thing, John, is this was Kirk during the Georgia-Texas game. Meanwhile, Texas is down 34-10 in the fourth quarter. Let's just keep that in mind. This is what Kirk Herbstreit had to say during that game, but yet he doesn't care about the SEC.
We talked about this morning on College Game Day with the schedule Texas has. We said, you know, you got to go to Athens, and then you have Texas A&M at home. It was kind of a consensus that if they were to split those two games, they would still be in the discussion, even with three losses, because of that massive game at the end of the year against number three, Texas A&M, who obviously came back to win today. They got to be the Sark's got to be the happiest guy in the world that A&M won that game. So they lose tonight. You wonder, it will be a discussion when it comes to being an at-large team if they were to win at home against Texas A&M. So if you look at this and you think, oh, three losses, they're done. I don't know. Just quite yet.
I don't know. Just quite yet if they're out. You had a five seed in 2023. A five seed made it to the national championship game in the NCAA tournament, a 5 seed playing in the Mountain West Conference. And everybody said in 2023 that the SEC had the best basketball. Look at all the teams they had in. Look at all the Elite Eight teams. Look at all the Sweet 16 teams. And yet in the end, it was a 5 seed playing against UConn for the national championship. And I got to tell you, that's what a tournament's about. If you are a 3-loss team playing in the SEC, you're pretty good. Like, that's a really good team. A 3-loss team playing in the Big Ten is pretty good. But this isn't a tournament where the line of delineation is pretty good. This is a true tournament where the line of delineation is you are the cream of your conference, and you are going to be compared and then seeded against the other teams that are the cream of their conference. It's why the Power Four conference champions in most years are all getting in, and then the highest rated Group of Five champion is getting in. It's supposed to be a selection of the best, and then let's see what happens in the bracket. Now, in most years, of course, the SEC champion and the Big Ten champion are going to be highly ranked teams and teams picked to win it. But pandering aside, if we can set down the idea and acknowledge, can we recognize that the BCS, the era of the BCS tournament and the 2-team playoff and the 4-team playoff were not really playoffs at all. They were invitationals. You got an invite. You didn't play your way in. A playoff is you win your conference, you're the conference champion, you're in, and then a selection committee picks at-large berths. That's a real tournament and a playoff. You have a system in which you qualify for the postseason. In a 4-team playoff, it was an invitational tournament. Everybody was just selected. Conference champions weren't automatically in. And here you go. Best 4 teams. Let's see what happens. But I think Herbie's argument falls apart when you just look over at the NCAA tournament bracket and you see teams like Butler win it all. And you see a San Diego State get to the national championship game. And you buy it, you know, every year there's a uninvited guest in the Final Four and there's several in the Elite Eight. And it's why you play the tournament. We think the SEC is really good, but let's go see it. And look, the SEC, it's not like you're going to have representation. 3 or 4 teams are getting in. Big Ten. 3 teams are getting in, maybe 4 if things break differently. The Big 12 champions getting in, the ACC champions getting in. I don't see why we should be clamoring to see a Texas team that lost at Florida badly and lost, got embarrassed by 35 points to Georgia. It's like we've seen what you can do. You're not deserving of being in the bracket and in the tournament because you have 3 losses. Here's the other argument. Nobody's banging the drum at ESPN for USC or Oregon, and you got a similar circumstance coming down the pipeline that is going to be even more egregious. There's a possibility that both Oregon and USC end up with 2 losses, and that one of them may be out of the tournament, a 2-loss team in the Big Ten, because you could see a scenario in which USC maybe beats Oregon this weekend, and then Oregon beats Washington to finish the year. What do you do with those 2 10-2 teams in the Big Ten? I'll tell you what the voters will do. They'll put USC in front of Oregon in that scenario, and I think Oregon potentially could be in some trouble at 10-2. Especially if the loss comes in, you know, by double digits or similar to the Indiana game. On the other side of the coin, if Oregon wins out and, you know, beats USC and beats Washington, the committee has essentially told us they don't believe that Oregon has played anybody. There's a scenario in which Oregon could get to the end of the year if they beat USC and USC loses to UCLA. Oregon could get to the end of the year without a win over a ranked team. What does that mean? Does it mean anything? They don't control that. They don't control the strength of schedule. The only ranked team they played was Indiana, potentially. 503-417-7575. Love to get your take on all of this. It is a bottleneck, and it's going to be interesting. Let's go to the phone lines. Dave is in Vancouver. He's going to lead us off. Dave, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for letting me on, John.
You bet.
It's a little bit different of what you're talking about. It's more about the financials. I was reading again about the Kelly, the coach of, was it LSU?
Yeah.
And he's
Brian Kelly.
The $54 million buyout. I'm not really familiar with the financials, but on the buyout, does the money paid come from the university, or does the donors pay that? And who is under the contractual obligation to pay that. I thought it was the AD that makes the contract and the regents sign off on that. So I'm just really curious. And what's preventing that from getting even higher? Like, some people might get up to $100 million. And does that come from, taxpayer money?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways to fuzz that up, Dave. And, it's even getting fuzzed up at a place like Oregon State. Like, Scott Barnes, the athletic director there, he says, donor money, not university money, will be used to pay out Trent Bray what they owe Trent Bray, the football coach. Well, if you really dig down on it, they're just sliding money around on the plate, like moving peas around the plate. And, the money can come from the donor side. It can come from the athletic department side. But the semantics of that publicly, the schools always want you to think it's donor money that pays for the buyouts. But if that donor money is allocated to pay for the coaching buyout, then you got to use money that would be in your general fund for other things that you would have used the donor money for. It's just you're sliding your finances around the plate. It's never good when you owe a coach $50 million or $70 million. That's money. The idea, though, that these athletic directors in these schools are paying these coaches the money, you better believe that when these ADs make these deals, a lot of them do so knowing that they're not going to be around if things go badly. And so they make the deal going, well, it's sort of like an interest-only loan where if the balloon payment comes due at the end, I'm not going to be here to see it anyway. TJ's in Portland, 503-417-7575. TJ, welcome.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm well.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I agree with you on the 12-3 Texas. I don't think they should be in. I think that it's everybody wants to see Arch Manning, and that's TV ratings, and that's my take on it. I don't think that he should be put in that game. He has three losses this season.
Yeah. I just sort of like the mindset that there's two different ways to approach the playoff. One of them is, are you picking the 12 best teams? Is that the objective of the committee? If the committee's objective is just pick the 12 best teams, then yeah, you're going to have some three-loss teams in the SEC that you certainly would rank in front of teams with two losses in both the Big 12 and the ACC.
But why? Because they're recruiting rankings? Because what they were picked at the start of the season? We all talk about the AP poll doesn't matter. Like, what makes Texas better than BYU right now?
And I don't think Texas is better than BYU, but the perception is. But I think you would have, like,
Utah would be the team because they have two losses.
Yeah, I don't love Utah's team. Like, I actually think Utah could lose a game here down the stretch to a team that's not ranked. Like, I just haven't been totally sold on Utah. Like, they're pretty good, but they're not great. And so, yeah, I might be tempted to take Texas as a good example. Let's say Texas beats Texas A&M. That's a really good win to knock off an undefeated team. And I look at them and I go, yeah, they lost to Florida. And then I look at Utah and I go, Utah got blown out by Texas Tech. I might be tempted to slip Texas in front of Utah. But that's only if my objective is, hey, you're just ranking the 12 best teams 1 to 12. That's not how it quite works. Just like the NCAA tournament, we have automatic qualifiers. The five highest ranked conference champions are getting in. And so then I start to look at beyond that, like, yes, I want some of this to play out on the field. And I look at BYU, especially. I like to see BYU play somebody. Like, I'm not high on Notre Dame either. Notre Dame has, should put a statue of Jack Swarbrick in front of the stadium because he negotiated a deal for Notre Dame where they pretty much get in if they're a two-loss team every year. There's some shenanigans and there's some tomfoolery and ballyhoo at play here. But I think, for me, if you are a two-loss team in the Power Four, you're in play. I think once you hit three losses, I can't really seriously think about you.
And this season's going to be weird, John, because you're right. If Texas has three losses at the end of the season, and I think they will. I think they'll beat Texas A&M. And Texas A&M They have beaten nobody besides Notre Dame.
They've had such a favorable schedule.
You want to know what the conference record is that they've faced this season in the SEC? Their opponents are 11-37 in conference in the SEC. They've beaten nobody in the SEC. I think Texas will beat Texas A&M, and that will just make it so it's so much easier to put Texas in there because, you beat Texas A&M. They're undefeated, all that kind of stuff. And I think it's false. Like, they should not be allowing teams in that. Not with three losses, man.
There should be a rule saying if you're a three-loss team, you're eliminated. But let's go to the phones. Mark's in Portland. Mark, welcome to the conversation.
How you doing? Hey, yeah, exactly. It's just like baseball, John. Three strikes and you're out. There's 12 teams in this playoff. So if they put Texas in, they're going to have five SEC teams in a tournament with 12 teams. So it should be capped. Look at the NFL. I mean, if you don't qualify for the playoffs, even though we might think Kansas City is good enough to get in this year, they have to earn it, and they're not going to take five teams from one division. It doesn't work that way. So there should be no conference should get more than four teams in. And every year they're going to do this with the polls. They're biased. They're going to rank seven or eight SEC teams. So at the end of the year, all their teams that are 10-2, well, we played a way tougher schedule than USC or anybody in the Big Ten, and we just don't know who the best teams are until we settle it on the field. Last year, we found out that the Big Ten at the top definitely was better. And we just don't know until we do it, but there should be a cap, and we do need 16 teams. So you can have four SEC teams, maybe four Big Ten teams, and then two automatic bids in the ACC and the Big 12, and then you have at-large bids. But nobody should get, even with 16 teams, nobody should get more than 14. So that way, I'm going to know that if the Ducks beat USC and lose to Washington, they're going to be the third-place team probably still. If Michigan loses to Ohio State, they'll be the third-place team. Are they? They should have an automatic bid if you're the third-place team in the Big Ten. That's the way I feel. If the SEC is going to get five teams in, we should get three teams in.
Here's the other thing, Mark. Let's say the other way around. Let's say Oregon loses to USC but beats Washington. You got 10-2 Oregon. You got 10-2 USC. I think Oregon would be in trouble in that scenario.
I said a couple of weeks ago, there's no doubt Oregon is out if they lose to USC because USC is going to go ahead of them, and they're not going to put four Big Ten teams in. This is a playoff game. Spread the word at Oregon. This week on Saturday, it is a do-or-die playoff game between USC and Oregon. You have to win that game. If they win that game and lose to Washington, they're going to have a strong argument with two losses. But if they lose to USC, you know exactly what they're going to say. You haven't beat any ranked teams all year, and they'll potentially put a three-loss team, Texas, ahead of Oregon if they lose to USC. This is a playoff game. Get your butt to Austin and get ready. It's win or you're dead. You're done. The season's over.
Mark in Portland laying down the gauntlet. Hey, here's the other thing, too, is if you are like the Group of Five champion, and right now we don't know that, it's going to be a real race to see who gets in there. Last week, it seems like every time there's a G5 team that crops up, they get beat. South Florida gets beat. Memphis gets beat. San Diego State and Boise State both lose with the opportunity right in front of them 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Whoever the 12 seed is, Stephen, the scenario I would die for if I'm a 12 seed is playing number 5 Texas A&M if Texas A&M loses to Texas. Because I think Texas A&M is vulnerable as a 5 seed or potential there as the 5 seed. But you have to go to Texas A&M to play that game.
Right, I agree with you, and I think that's the spot. Is if you're the 12 seed and you're that Group of Five team, depending on who the number five team is in the CFP poll, you may have a chance because a lot of these teams, even Ohio State, I think Ohio State is great. They play nobody. Do we actually know if they're super elite or not? They played Texas. They scored 14 points. I know they've gotten a lot better, but they've also played nobody. So I think there are a lot of questions. And you're right. If A&M is to lose to Texas, they probably fall out of the top five. They play the SEC title game. They lose that. Are they number five team in the nation? I think there is vulnerable spots a lot of the ways here for the college football playoff. And to Mark's point, I think it's great. Let's start spreading that word, John. This is a playoff game for the Ducks. Because I agree. If Oregon loses this game to USC, I think that they're out. And I think that is just craziness that you would put Oregon out with two losses and you put an SEC teams in with three losses.
You know what the tournament needs to is it needs the 12 seed to win a game. It needs James Madison over Texas A&M. It needs North Texas over, Texas Tech. Whoever's playing in that game, you need a 12 seed to win the game because you need to demonstrate to the world and to the committee that, hey, once you get into the playoff, this is, while football is different than basketball, and usually the better, the better, more physical team, the better, more talented team wins the game, there are still things that happen. And Arizona State damn near proved that last year. They had Texas on the ropes, and I think they were better than Texas. I think they had that thing won. You end up in overtime with them. And so I think the tournament needs something like that this year, and this may be the year that we get it. All right, leave it here. We got so much more ahead. Our big splash coming up later this hour. We got to talk about Sam Darnold. Is he colorblind? I don't know. We'll figure that out. Plus more of your phone calls, 503-417-7575.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I got to be honest. People in San Diego had no idea what to do with a little rain. I was there on Saturday, and it was raining, but it wasn't raining, it was kind of a light drizzle and a mist at times, and people were freaking out over there all day long, and they're not used to it, but saw a lot of people walking around with umbrellas, and at the game, they had their ponchos on. It was like a big weather thing for the people in San Diego, and I was like, it's not that much.
So it's like every customer that's at Costco when it rains?
Yes.
That whole place goes into a panic.
Yeah. They were panicked. They were freaking out. I had a on press row there at Snapdragon Stadium, I had the Aztec student daily newspaper sitting next to me, and there were two writers that are writing for the student paper, and I was kind of picking their brains. I was like, hey, why don't more students go to the games? Because the campus is like 12-minute drive from the stadium. And they said, oh, they do, but they go, it's raining today. And I was like, what does that mean? It's raining. And they're like, well, that weather's going to keep people away. There's too many things to do. And so I think they lean too much on the idea that there's so much to do there, and that's why people don't go to Snapdragon Stadium. I think the problem is that the community in San Diego, much the same way as the Bay Area sports fan in California's Bay Area, it's a very transient community. I do think you have a core group of people who grew up there and go to the games and understand Marshall Faulk and, everything that happened in the past with San Diego State. But I think there is not that sort of we've lived it for generations feel. That's why the SEC does that better than anybody.
But they get a ton of support for the basketball team. Like, that place is loaded when they're not, national title contenders.
Kawhi Leonard and Steve Fisher captured that community with their runs. They went to two Sweet 16s. But think about what you need to make noise. You need 12,000 in that building. It sells it out. You need about 35,000, 40,000 to do the same in football. And so I do think there's 12,000 dedicated football fans. And there's 12,000 dedicated basketball fans, but there's not 12,001, in football. That's really where it starts to fall off. Their season ticket sales numbers are only about 7,500. That's not enough to move the needle, even with a really good team. Sean Lewis has got a really good team. They are defensively very good. And in a 16-team playoff, if you were going to put two G5 teams in, San Diego State would be kind of a fun little team to see in there. They're not going to get anywhere near the 12-team playoff unless there's absolute chaos with James Madison and, North Texas. But
that loss to Hawaii is so brutal now because they,
loss.
With Memphis losing, with all these teams, USF losing.
They would have been right there.
They would have been right there.
And San Diego State, this is another interesting thing. Highest that San Diego State's ever been ranked in the AP Top 25 is 16th. And they haven't been ranked above number 21 since Marshall Faulk suited up. So what Sean Lewis is doing is pretty impressive. And the question is, can San Diego State keep him? Or will he be drawn away for another job? I've been talking a lot to coaches and ADs about the Oregon State job. Jason Eck last week. We had Sean Lewis on the show. I was down in San Diego. I got a chance to be around Spencer Danielson and Sean Lewis at the stadium. And there's a lot of interest in what Oregon State and Colorado State are going to do with their hires. But I think a lot of people are looking over at San Diego State and going, can they keep Sean Lewis for one more year? That's what they need to do. One more year and then see what happens. Roy is in Portland. The phone number is 503-417-7575. Roy, you got to be riding high today.
Yeah, I'm riding high today, John. But your story about San Diego reminded me about 10 years ago. It was like 2 inches of snow hit Georgia, yeah, and Atlanta completely shut down. You would have thought it was like a blizzard, like of 10 feet of snow. I mean, it was a light dusting, and people was losing their mind. I mean, you couldn't get anywhere. It was gridlock. People was leaving their cars on the expressway and walking. It's just, it's just crazy. Some places that's not used to something, a weather event, how they react to it.
Yeah.
So, they were
going to give the AD at San Diego State said he tried to buy 20,000 ponchos on Amazon. He was going to give them away at the stadium. And I was like, these people, they know how to wear a jacket and bring an umbrella.
Yeah. Hey, John, this season is shaping up to be a good one. Oregon, man, like I said, if they lose, whoever wins this game is going to the playoffs. Whoever loses is going home. Mm. Okay. Because, you know, you can't have Oregon scheduled and lose this game. And I think, I don't know, man. I think that if the Pac-12 was still around, man, this is what makes me mad about the Pac-12 dissolving. The Big Ten, I'm sorry, you know, Mark from Portland, all like, the Big Ten is sorry, man. You got the top two teams, okay, Ohio State and Indiana, but you got Oregon and USC as part of the top four. So if you take Oregon and USC out the Big Ten, it's just Indiana and Ohio State,
yeah,
and maybe Michigan. I mean, look, Arizona and Arizona State, both of them 7-3, they having a pretty good season. Oregon State wouldn't be in the turmoil they're in if the Pac-12 was still around.
Right.
They probably would have a good season with Jonathan Smith. UCLA wouldn't be as bad. They probably would have had a decent season. Cal is a decent team right now. Utah is a good team. You would have had a great conference, and you might have gotten in. You might have gotten two teams in this year in the Pac-12 if it was still around. You know, I mean, or the Pac-12 winner automatically was going to, let's say that's Oregon, so they automatically in. UCLA might have gotten in. I mean, so the whole thing to me, man. I mean, to me, the Big Ten still doesn't make sense for the Pac-12. I know people. The sticking point to me is still the travel.
Yeah.
The travel, man, after we've done this experiment, the traveling to me is not going to work, man. It's just too much, even in football and basketball. I mean, you see when it seems like when the Big Ten teams come out to the West Coast, they can't win. And when the West Coast teams go to the Midwest and the East Coast, they can't win. So,
true.
I mean, it's like they need to do something about this, man. I don't like it, but I do think that whoever wins this game, and I think I'm putting my money on Oregon. I think Oregon will win this game. I think Oregon is a better team than USC. But, you know, strange things have happened before, but I just don't see USC having enough to stop Oregon at this time. And I do see Lincoln Riley leaving USC. Maybe not this year, but in the next couple years, I don't see him staying at USC for the long term.
He ran away from Oklahoma when Oklahoma was headed to the SEC. And I think he thought he had a better job with USC going into the Big Ten. And then Oregon came. And Oregon's in front of USC. I think Oregon's not only going to beat USC, I think they're going to beat USC by double digits. I think it's going to be a statement win. And I think Oregon at home, I got a hard time picking against Oregon. I don't know if you saw Lincoln Riley, Stephen, on the field at the end of the Iowa game. He was screaming victory. He was, you know, it was a really interesting look because it's exactly the kind of game USC would lose in years past. They had a bad first half, came back in the second half, won the game, and then closed it out. But I just think Iowa does not have enough firepower to win that kind of game. Or USC's offense was just a little better. Oregon, I think, is going to score on USC. I don't think Oregon's going to have any trouble scoring. I think Oregon will be in the 30s. I think USC will be in the 20s, and I think it's going to be a convincing win for Oregon. And I think Roy's right. If the old Pac-12 had just stayed together, I think you would have Oregon at the top. I think you would have USC right behind them. I think you'd have this next group of that would be very, very respectable would be Utah, and I would even put Washington in there, and Arizona State, and Arizona, and I think Oregon State would, you know, would not be an embarrassment, because I do agree Jonathan Smith would stay. I think they'd have a lot more momentum. It would be a really good conference. I think you'd get two teams in this year.
And I agree. And I think the thing about Roy and you are talking about the Pac-12 is with Washington. I look at them. Like, they lost to Wisconsin, and I feel a lot of it was because of the travel. Like, they've every time they've traveled, you know, past, you know, the Rocky Mountains, they've been horrible. And I feel like they would probably have a better record if they were the Pac-12 is around, because they're just traveling to the West Coast teams. And they kind of match up better than they do against those Big Ten teams. And so I think that's a team that I would look at as like, yeah, they have, what, three losses on this season. But if you take away their schedule, made it the Pac-12 schedule, they may have one loss right now. Like, I think they would be a lot better record-wise going into, you know, the end of this season, rather than having to go on the road and play a Wisconsin team who's just going to try to beat you up and play tough defense. And you're also traveling, you know, multiple time zones. I think that is a problem. And Roy kind of touched on that as well. Like, the travel, I think, really hurts these teams. I mean, it is a shame that the Pac-12 has gone away, because that conference would be, it would have been really good the last couple seasons with this college football playoff.
Yeah. And look, you know, maybe it comes back together someday. Somebody asked me the question in the Monday mailbag, you know, what is the future for, you know, for the potential for teams to come back into the Pac-12? But I'll tell you what I heard when I was down at the San Diego State Boise State game is there was a lot of talk about Stanford and Cal. Being like, forget the Big Ten, because they're getting money there, and money's going to glue you there until it doesn't. But the ACC, to me, is still vulnerable. And if the ACC implodes, Stanford and Cal don't have anywhere to go. Big Ten's not taking them. So they have to come back, or they have to go to the Big 12, or they have to play as independents, or they have to come up with something else. And I know that the academics at Stanford and Cal don't want to be caught dead with Boise State and Fresno State and that group. But you may have no choice but to compete and to get over it. And I think Stanford and Cal, like, Cal could compete in that conference. Cal could win that conference. Cal could end up as a participant in the playoff playing in that conference. They can't do that in the ACC. And they're getting home at 3 o'clock in the morning for these road games to North Carolina you know, Pitt and Syracuse.
And you talk about the Big Ten being good for those teams. I feel like the Big 12 teams as well, Utah, Colorado, and the Arizona schools all kind of fit with the Big 12 pretty well. Like, it seemed like it's kind of been a seamless fit with those four schools.
It has, but are they going to... Let's see. Let's see how often they make the playoff. Let's see how often, you know... I like Arizona State's positioning and Arizona's positioning. I worry about Utah longer term. Colorado's fallen off the map now. Coach Prime, I think he's lost all momentum. But we'll see. Let's go to Josh in Vancouver. Josh, welcome to the conversation.
Hey, John. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. Hey, can you indulge me just for a second and go a little bit conspiracy here? But I really think that the selection committee and ESPN and all the power brokers that are involved with SEC are really doing everything that they can to talk down and diminish everything that the Big Ten is doing this year. And here's why I say that. No more evidence was clear than when Indiana won a close game at Penn State and everybody made such a big deal about how impressive of a win that was. And they played against a team that lost their coach and lost their quarterback and their season was in shambles. But that was such an impressive win. But when Oregon did the same thing, it wasn't impressive because now they're a bad team. When Oregon went to Iowa and beat Iowa, it wasn't impressive. Iowa travels across the country. USC beats them in a close game, almost loses to them. I would argue that that last drive, that was a catch at the end of the game. They were in position to lose that game. What an impressive win that is for USC at home, not for Oregon. But the biggest nail in the coffin to this little conspiracy theory I have is this. In the selection show last week, not once, other than announcing Oregon's name, did they talk about Oregon at all. They're treating Oregon like they do not belong in the conversation, and it feels very intentional. Now, I get it. Oregon has had several games this year. It hasn't been the best. The Big Ten at the top is top-heavy with two teams, debatably. But, yes, it comes down to USC and Oregon. But, John, at the end of the day, they are actively trying to push the narrative that the Big Ten only deserves three teams, and it is not based on merit on the field, because the argument that the Big Ten teams haven't played anybody is the same argument that you can use against the SEC and the schedules that they're playing when they're moving teams like Ole Miss up by playing the Citadel. Thanks, buddy. Talk soon.
Yeah. How about Texas A&M, period, end stop. You could go up and down, and keep in mind, the SEC and ESPN are partners. They are business partners. What is good for the SEC is good for ESPN. What is good for ESPN is good for the SEC. All you have to do is tune in.
This is supposed to be a night to celebrate where the SEC is, but I'm getting angry listening to this conversation because, Greg, we're all dumbfounded by what we heard last year, and we have laid a marker from the SEC at the feet of the CFP, and they better deliver. And I'm not making threats because I don't have any more control over it than anybody else, but I know some people who do, and if they screw this up, they will be paying for it. And I don't know how or will, but they should, because this is unequivocal what the SEC has laid down tonight.
Look, the SEC is absolutely threatening the selection committee. They're saying, if you don't give us what we want, we're going to take our ball and we're going to go home eventually. We don't need to play in this tournament. We'll go make our own thing up. And by the way, we've got the backing of ESPN, who owns the college football playoff. And so, yeah, I have watched the selection committee, and I think it would take a lot of guts, but I've watched the selection committee sort of cave in to the whims of the SEC and overrank their teams and make sure that they feel they're more than fair to the SEC. I really do wonder if we're going to get to a position eventually where if the college football playoff had multiple TV networks involved, let's say Fox was in, let's say the CW was in, what if the TV partners were allowed to pick the field? Be a very different field. It wouldn't be a deserving field. We'd get Notre Dame in there every year. We'd have all the big brands in there. Oregon, certainly, like this, you know, this ESPN game day thing where Game Day's coming back to Eugene. Like, I'm in the Pacific Northwest. I should celebrate this. This is great. It's great for the visibility of the region. It's great for Oregon. It's great that they're coming back to Eugene for the second time. But I think if I were advising Game Day, I would have said, yeah, you should probably go to that James Madison Washington State game. That's the best story of the weekend. Who's going to get the G5 berth? Rather than go back to Eugene again for a second time this season. But that's not what moves the needles. What moves the needle is the LA TV market, USC's involved in the game, and Oregon's brand. And by the way, the SEC doesn't own the Big Ten. This is a last chance for it to get a little bite, take off a little slice of the Big Ten and claim it as its own. Show up in Oregon twice every year, and you can do that. Oregon's not going to balk at that because they love the publicity, they love the visibility. But yeah, ESPN's at work right now. They're working really hard to make sure that they get the right teams in the playoff, and the SEC is well represented because it bodes well for their long-term TV contract. The Big Splash is coming up. 503-417-7575 is the number.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I feel like the college football playoff is a little bit like a carnival, except we're all just kind of like, some of us know that the carnival games are rigged. Most of the time when you go to play in the carnival, you go into a casino in Vegas, you kind of accept that the house has got the odds in their favor. The illusion in sports, though, is that the playing field is level. I think we have to kind of, if we want to let the committee do their job, I think we kind of have to back off and go, okay, let's see what you do with the field. But I don't trust that they're going to do what's right with about teams number 10 and 11. Those are the spots I'm really worried about. Because 10 and 11 will be the last two teams in, because the group of five champion is going to be the 12 seed. So look, 9, 10, 11, that's going to get a little dicey in there as the announcement comes forth in the next couple of weeks. A lot of people talking about conference championship games. My good pal, Dan Wetzel, who I've known for years, says that the conference championship games should go away. I agree with Wetzel in theory. They don't serve a great purpose. And in fact, you might be better served to let the third and fourth place teams play to maybe position yourself better to get a play, an extra playoff team in. The problem is that these conferences, the Big Ten and the SEC and the ACC and the Big 12 and the American and the Pac-12 and the Mountain West, they've all sold the television rights for their conference championship game to TV partners. And these are deals that go all the way to 2032 and 2034 and 2036. And so, you know, these deals are going to be part of the TV package. The Pac-12's conference championship game in 2026 and beyond will be carried by CBS. They're going to have it. And so I don't think the games will go away, but you may tweak the format. Here's what Wetzel thinks.
I think that, too, the conference championship game weekend, it just mucks up the schedule, and we have this, like, the national championship game, which you should watch on the ESPN family networks, of course, but it's in, like, January 20th. Like, it would be so much, like, I don't know that it works for fans that the season just goes on and on and on. And we don't make a lot of decisions, certainly not at these decision levels where why do we have 18 team conferences and why do we have all this stuff? And why do we ask fans to travel to three straight playoff games? Like, nothing's ever about the fans. Nobody's ever thinking about what's good for fans. And that's why I think there's a lot of fans that are saying, I'd rather have a home playoff game.
And here's why, that's a reason why I think the New World Pac-12, when they announce where their conference championship game's going to be, I think they're going to make that conference championship game be at the High Seeds home stadium. I don't think they're going to go to Vegas. I don't think they're going to go to L.A. They're not going to go to Levi's Stadium in San Francisco. I think they're going to say, hey, San Diego State, you're in first place. You get to host the game. Oregon State, you're in first place. You get to host the game. Because it's simply asking too much of fans. Leave it here. Stick around.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
When my middle daughter was born, we went over to the hospital because you know how it was a... When you have a pregnancy happening in your household, don't know if you did this, Stephen, but you go through these birthing classes. It's kind of like the walkthrough that football teams do prior to playing a football game. So I remember we went over to the hospital, kind of doing the walkthrough. You know, the football teams will get out there, they'll stretch out, get the lay of the land, run a couple plays. Kickers will kick some field goals. Kind of look around the stadium. You get acclimated. You do the same thing when you've got a baby coming. That first baby, especially. Maybe the veterans out there that have had multiple kids, you go, yeah, I got it down. Second one, you're doing a drive-by into the hospital. We're slowing down to 20. Letting the pregnant lady kind of hop out of the car while it's still moving. And you go into the birthing room. But that first time, I was so excited because they took us around and showed us all the birthing rooms and everything. And you get to meet the hospital staff and you say, there's the nursery. That's where the baby will be. And that's where babies are actually born in this room. And then the nurse took me down the hallway and showed me this freezer that was down the hallway at this hospital. It was one of the legacy hospitals. And she opened up the freezer, Stephen, and it was jam-packed with ice cream sandwiches. Fat boy ice cream sandwiches, wall-to-wall in this freezer. And I was very excited about the birth of the child. But as a secondary thing, I made a mental note to myself that after the baby's born, I'm going to mosey down here and get myself an ice cream sandwich. And this was on my mind. Probably not on anyone else's mind. So lo and behold, the baby comes. It's a long, extended labor. The baby is born. The nurse hands me the baby, baby girl. And I remember looking into her eyes. She's looking back at me. And they take her and they start to do all the tests that they do right away on the baby. And while they were doing that, I excused myself from the room. And I walked down the hallway. And there was a little bit of joy in my heart as I approached that, freezer, giant freezer. Good idea on whoever put it there. A little bit of joy in my heart as I reached for the handle and I opened the freezer. And then I was completely devastated because the freezer was empty. It was empty. And my jaw must have hit the floor. And I looked around and one of the nurses walked by and I said, "No ice cream sandwiches?" And she said, "You're supposed to bring them yourself." Whoever had been in the hospital that day when I opened the freezer a month earlier during the walkthrough had apparently brought those ice cream sandwiches. I thought they were provided as a complimentary amenity for the individual who had created the life that was going on in this hospital. You don't have a business without dad around, do you? But you can't really make that argument because nobody's thinking about you, Dad. It's all about Mom. It's all about the baby. And I've told young fathers that since then. Whenever I encounter somebody that I know that's going to have that baby, I said, they go, "What do I need to expect?" And I said, "I got three things for you. You need to pack a go bag, big guy. Pack a go bag. Put a fresh T-shirt in there. You're going to need a change of shirt. You know, it could be a long night. Put some deodorant in there, put a couple of granola bars in there, and a bottle of water. And by the way, if they've got a freezer, it's BYO ice cream sandwiches. They're not going to give them to you. Complimentary ice cream sandwiches. It makes me want to have another baby, just so I can pack that freezer full of ice cream sandwiches. And, you know, I'll put a lawn chair there. And sit there with great delight afterwards. And forget smoking a cigar. Remember the old days people would say, "Oh, his dad was handing out a cigar after the baby was born." I don't know why my mind went to an ice cream sandwich. Probably because the hospital planted the ice cream sandwich in my brain. So there's that.
It sounds like the coach forgot a little step in the game plan. Like they didn't game plan correctly. They didn't tell you that you had to bring the ice cream sandwiches. Like, "Oh, we forgot to tell you that they like to run the read option on third and short." Like, they, you know, they need to tell you those type of things.
Yeah, but it's kind of like you show up to the game, you bring, you know, you bring the equipment, you know, you bring what you need. I just thought it was my bad. Like when they showed me the freezer and they opened it and it's filled wall to wall, it didn't look like one little box of ice cream sandwiches. Somebody went all out.
Some dad was having a good time.
Yeah, he went ice cream sandwiches for everyone. Ring a bell. Ding, 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 ding. It's on me. You know, it was there was something like that going on, unless he like they had like septuplets or something. But I assumed you never should assume anything. I assumed the ice cream sandwiches were there for me. You never make assumptions, especially when it relates to childbirth. I'll tell another story. I had a friend of mine, his name was Vaughn. He was the wide receivers coach, Vaughn Webb. He was the wide receiver coach at Fresno State years ago when I was covering Fresno State. He's black and his wife was white. And it was very important to Vaughn because he had missed sort of the appointments that led up to the births of his other children. He was there when the children were born, but he had missed sort of the OBGYN prenatal appointments, hearing the heartbeat, going in for the appointment, you know, the especially as the birth gets close, it almost becomes like a weekly thing that you last few weeks of the final trimester. And so it was very important to Vaughn that he did it for this one child, this last child. And I'd love for if his kid could hear this story because Vaughn died just a couple years ago of a heart attack. And I thought, oh, man, I hope his kid knows it. I should reach out and find this kid. Kid's probably 20 years old now. But this Vaughn was going to the prenatal appointments like clockwork. And I remember being at a Fresno State practice. And I want to say David Carr was the quarterback at the time. And Vaughn had to leave practice early, and he was like, "I have to get to this appointment." So later I said to him, "What happened?" He goes, "Oh, my goodness, I have to tell you what happened." He said, "I jam over to the OBGYN's office, and I come scrambling through the door, and he's out of breath because he's basically from the practice field to his car, to the parking lot, running into the place because he doesn't want to miss this appointment. It was the final appointment before the birth of his child. And as he gets to the front desk, he's out of breath and he says, my wife is in here. She's doing her final prenatal appointment. And the receptionist looked at him and said, room 6. And you know what happened? Vaughn walked into room 6, and there was an African-American woman in the stirrups in room 6 getting ready for an appointment who let out a shriek. Vaughn apologized and closed the door, and he went back to the front desk, and he said, my wife is white. And they said, oh, room 4. You never assume, Stephen. You never make the assumption. My mother was a mother-baby nurse. She said the same thing to me. She said, in the delivery room, you never assume that guy standing next to the mom is the father and not the grandfather, or you don't assume it's the grandfather. She said some horrible things have been said in those rooms that are unforgivable, where people will go, oh, you have a grandchild. Oh, actually, that's my daughter. I digress. We're going to play a little Punch It audio. Let's do it.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Georgia coach Kirby Smart got physical. Physical win for Georgia. Big win for Georgia. They looked great on the field in blowing out Texas 35-10. Kirby Smart says that's no accident. He's recruiting physical players.
Yeah, it's the approach we take. We're gonna dominate and try to win the fourth quarter. It's what we do in practice. It's what we do in the offseason. It's what we build our core culture around, is being a more physical team. You have to recruit physical players, and they have to buy into that process. I don't know that a lot of these kids nowadays, they want to check. They don't want physicality. And if you have the check and no physicality, you end up with nothing. So we're not just getting checks at our place. We're hitting people.
Not just getting checks. We're hitting people. 21-point fourth quarter for the Bulldogs. They won that quarter 21-0. They go on to win 35-10. Kirby Smart and the Georgia Bulldogs are 9-1. And they are dangerous. Meanwhile, Sam Darnold, 4 interceptions in a 21-19 loss to the Rams. Ryan Clark says you can't forget Sam Darnold's history.
It is just one game, but you can't forget about history, right? It's one game added to the history of Sam Darnold, added to the way he played in Minnesota, but the way that season finished with the Detroit game and then the Los Angeles Rams in the playoffs. The one thing we knew about both of these teams is they had units that could win a Super Bowl, and we had 2 quarterbacks playing at an MVP level. Now, Matthew Stafford wasn't his normal 2025 version of himself either, but for Sam Darnold, I saw it early. He threw that first interception, and he continued to press to try to erase and delete that mistake, and you just can't do that against a team as opportunistic with the pressure of the Los Angeles Rams.
And yet, the Seahawks had a chance there, Steven, still to overcome 4 interceptions, 21-19 loss to the Rams. The margins are thin in the NFL, but Darnold was not good for the Seahawks.
If you're a Seahawks fan, though, John, does that scare you going forward? Because I think you look at this game, the defense obviously played well enough to win, like tremendously enough to play, win this game. But this is another big-time situation where Sam Darnold's throwing a bunch of picks. Last year, as Ryan Clark said, it was that do-or-die game. Winner gets the 1 seed. They played the Lions. They got absolutely smoked. Then in the playoffs, gets smoked again. Is this a Sam Darnold problem? Like, is their ceiling capped because of their quarterback?
You tell me. I mean, would they be better off with Geno there or someone else?
Not Geno, but I think they are capped with Darnold. Like, going into the game, I thought, yeah, Seahawks, they could be the NFC representative after last week. I've changed my mind. No, I don't think they can.
No, but I think if you're a Seahawks fan, they're ahead of schedule with a new coach. They look like all the pieces are there, but they've got the age-old problem that plagues franchises that can't get over the top. They don't have that guy at quarterback. And there's a reason why teams go out and pay that guy $40 or $50 or $55 million that he can really play. Sam Darnold's not that guy. I think we knew that before, and I think you really know it now. Well, there was an incident with a trooper at the Texas A&M South Carolina game. Trooper, I don't know if you saw the video, Stephen, but he tended to, he appeared to puff up his chest and stick his elbows out and give some problems for some South Carolina players. Nick Harbor scored the touchdown. Police officer bumped him afterwards. Criminal defense attorney Craig Greaves talking about the incident.
I mean, there's nothing I could ever think in my mind that he would have a valid reason to do that. He is trying to start something. He went to them trying to start something, probably hopefully, you know, in his mind that, well, maybe I can get a reaction out of them, then I can arrest them or do whatever, you know, I don't know. But it's horrible, and it's humiliating for A&M to even have this be involved with their name. It really is.
You know what I saw there, too? Like, things weren't going their way. And I saw two things. One, I saw a police officer or a trooper or a law enforcement officer who turned into a fan. Secondarily, I couldn't ignore the element of I'm in a position of authority and you're not that was going on in that interaction. And I shudder to think what that law enforcement officer is like in his day-to-day.
That was my thought, is what is he doing when there's not 100,000 people in the stands and on national TV? If he's okay doing that in front of everybody, what is he doing off the camera? Because you're right. It was 26-3 in the second quarter. South Carolina just took that 26-3 lead. And he went out of his way to walk up the tunnel, bump the guys, turn around and yell at them. Like, he needs to be fired. Like, that's crazy behavior to do that on a national TV level like that.
And, you know, the teams hire those officers as security at the stadium, and a lot of them are off duty or they're making time and a half to do that. The troopers you see at Autzen Stadium, no different, or Research Stadium, no different. But certainly he's going to lose that element of the job. I don't think he'll be back at the stadium. But I also think you got to look at this guy and go, okay, was there other stuff in his past, and what is he doing out there? And, you know, what should his punishment be? I don't know. Make him go to practice. Let him return punts, you know.
Let South Carolina guys just level up.
South Carolina guys just.
But for
tackle.
Real though, like, he needs to be investigated further than what happened to that situation.
I'm looking hard at him.
Yeah, like, if you're doing that in front of all these people, like, what are you doing off the camera? I just can't even imagine.
There's an element too to the visibility of somebody like that, that, you know, if there's other stuff, you're going to hear about it in the coming days. Like, the, you know, somebody this is shaking the trees. Let's see what falls out of the trees. That happened with Mac Rhodes, the Baylor athletic director. Remember, he was the chair of the CFP committee. Then he had the incident where put his hands on a player on the sidelines and yelled at the player for having the wrong undershirt on. He was abusive. And then that got publicity. And then an illicit, apparently alleged relationship or some violation of conduct inside his athletic department has surfaced, and now all of a sudden, you know, he's going to be out of a job. It's just like drip, drip, drip goes the faucet. Tiago Splitter was not happy with the Blazers' defense. They're not totally healthy, but I like the accountability. Here's the coach.
You know, we want to play hard every game, but also we got to be smarter, especially defensively. I think, you know, on offense, you're going to miss or make shots sometimes. I think we created a lot of shots for us. 22 offense rebounds. Didn't make many, but defensively we gotta be better. Just one-on-one situations and like guard better and be smarter.
Gotta guard better, gotta be smarter. I like the accountability. Blazers lose to the Mavericks in overtime. They're now 6-7 on the season. They don't have a healthy point guard either, Steven. Are they in trouble right now?
I think there's a lot of questions about their offense, John. So when they miss Jrue Holiday, they're going to be in real trouble. They shot like 40% last night. Tiago spent it right there. They had 22 offensive rebounds, but they couldn't even score off those offensive rebounds. The offense is a huge problem. And defensively, it's not as good as we thought it was going to be. So, yes, I think there are some problems still going forward. I still do like this team. They play. It's not an effort thing. And that is a positive. It is not an effort thing. They come out. They give 100% night in and night out. It's more of an execution thing. And so I think that can be solved. But there are legitimate questions right now with the Blazers. Luckily, though, you know, I thought the West was going to be loaded. The bottom half of the West, you know, when you get to about seed 7, 8, 9, 10, not that great. So I think the Blazers, if they can get some wins, they can stay around in this hunt.
Dante Moore, Oregon quarterback, was fantastic. Very accurate on Friday night. Oregon beat Minnesota going away. Great performance. Dante Moore talking about it.
Yeah, just got to give the shout out to the 10 other players with me on the field. Just in general with them making the spectacular catches. The front five giving me time in the pocket. The running backs, you know, opening the run game. So, I mean, overall, I couldn't do it without them. It feels great to have that. It's a true blessing for sure. But without my teammates, I wouldn't have gotten done.
He was 27 of 30 passing. He threw one pass, and it was on a play-action pass on the goal line where he missed. He just missed badly. He got bailed out by Kenyon Sadiq, who made a great catch on a ball that was mildly overthrown. But other than that, Dante Moore was money.
Oregon single season completion percentage record for a single game was 90%, Dante Moore. He beat Kellen Clemens, who was 87, so Dante now has the record for that.
I was at that game that Clemens was very good at. And Clemens, that was a short passing attack. A lot of these balls were down the field, and I like what Oregon's doing on the offense right now, and they protected Dante Moore. They were efficient. They were physical. Oregon looks locked into me, and I think they're going to beat USC handily. Meanwhile, Oregon State laid an egg on the road at Tulsa. They were bad. Start of the game was bad. Tulsa just punched them, knocked them out. Rob Akey talking about it.
Well, it's the ball game. It doesn't matter where we play it. If we don't have our eyes on our job and a big play happens to you, then that's going to be a problem wherever we play the damn thing. That's the unfortunate part. I don't think the location of the game had anything to do with it. I think, you know, it's a matter of just doing our jobs at that point in time. And that's, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I really do think that's the deal. I don't think it matters where we were at. But, unfortunately, we didn't win on the road yet. So we get one more opportunity to do that. We can make that still happen, and that's what we're going to look to do.
Oregon State will get another road opportunity in Pullman, Washington in a couple weeks. Yeah, game on November 29th, the Pac-2 championship. Somebody asked me today in the Monday mailbag at johnconzano.com, if Washington State wins, then how do they settle? Who wins the Pac-2 championship? Because they would have split the games. And I'm not in favor of seeing a third game. I do not need to see that.
It's got to be point difference, right?
Yeah. I think you just take the wishbone of the turkey from Thursday, the Thursday before. And you let the starting quarterback settle it at midfield.
I think we just look at Oregon State's record and the way they've played, and they don't deserve a championship. I'll be honest. If they're 2-10, like, no, thank you.
There you go. And I love people who are now dropping into my DMs and tweeting at me saying, did I just hear you say that you would like to father another child because you want to get an ice cream sandwich?
I heard that, and I thought, that's kind of a weird decision there, John. I'll just go buy you one.
It's a long route to an ice cream sandwich.
Anna's got the clamps down there at home.
There you go.
Locking the freezer for you.
Long route to an ice cream sandwich. All right, leave it here. We got to talk about Shedeur Sanders. Excuses. Leave it here.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Yeah, never. So, you know, Chase and Luke are exactly right. They've lived it just like every backup has lived it. And what's interesting about being the backup is you don't get any reps, but when you're thrown in there, everyone wants you to play like a starter. And when you don't, no one says, oh, well, you know, little Timmy didn't get the reps. Like, it doesn't work that way. Like, that's how it goes.
Tim Hasselbeck talking about the reality of being a backup quarterback in the NFL. And that is the reality. You are a backup. You are a substitute. You are a spot player who is thrown into a pinch-hitting situation mid-game because there's an injury and, you know, Dylan Gabriel gets hurt. And you know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about Shedeur Sanders, who was not good in relief of Dylan Gabriel. Rough NFL debut as he comes into the game. And, you know, I first saw this on social media, and it was one of these times where social media was on it because I had heard Dylan Gabriel got hurt. I hadn't seen the film of Shedeur going into the game. I hadn't seen anything. And somebody on Twitter tweeted out Shedeur Sanders on his first NFL pass throws an 80-yard touchdown pass. And I clicked on the video, and in fact was a pick six going the other way. So there it was. Sanders completed his first two passes. Then he had an interception. He got sacked. His passer rating was 13.5. He did not play well. He scrambled three times for 16 yards. It wasn't a pick six, but it was an interception going the other way. But not good, and not the kind of debut you want. But that's the reality, and that's the position you're in. And that is a grown-up thing to be a backup quarterback in the NFL. And I bring up the grown-up thing because we cannot treat anybody who's in that situation like they are a child. You're making too much money. The job is to be prepared. The job is to know the offense. But the reality is we all know you're not getting the reps in practice. But the job, and this is where it comes back to kind of, are you prepared? Are you putting in the extra work? Are you staying after practice? Are you paying attention in meetings? Are you ready when your number's called? Because we have seen guys who are in that position who come in relief and are on it. And I think it's why, frankly, the Commanders in Washington gave Marcus Mariota $8 million. They're like, hey, we know that guy's going to take care of his business and he's going to be ready if we need him. And guess what? Most of these teams are going to need a backup quarterback at some point to come into the game. There's been a lot of public outcry for Shador. He got an opportunity and he looked bad. He comes in with 12:43 remaining in the third quarter against the Ravens. Dylan Gabriel's out with a concussion and he goes 4 for 16 for 47 yards, interception, 2 sacks. Low passer rating. Ravens go on. They rally for a 23-16 win. He didn't play well. He didn't look good. Why is it? Why does everybody want Shador to be good? Why is there so much excuse making out there for Shador Sanders? Even Tim Hasselbeck saying, well, you know, it's hard. You don't get the reps. Everybody expects you to be good. No. The problem is, I think that there was so much public backlash when he didn't get drafted high. That there's a lot of people out there who say he's not very good and you want to be right. And so you root against him. And there's other people going, he got a raw deal and they want to be right. And so they're rooting for him. And now because he didn't play well, it's not because he's not good. It's because he didn't have the reps. Well, he's going to get a start this week. He is projected as the starter coming up for week 12 and it'll be the Raiders on a short week. Okay. No excuses. The Raiders can't make excuses. If Shador torches them, the Raiders can't sit back and go, well, it was a short week. We didn't have any film on Shador. This is a big boy league. Big boy expectations. I can't stand when people lower the bar. Don't lower the bar for me in any capacity, ever. Don't lower the bar. Raise the expectations. Shador's a pro. He'll get there. He'll get there. And I actually think if he was with a different organization, not the Cleveland Browns, I'd give him a better chance of getting there. But this is the circumstance he's in. It was a rough great debut
for
him.
What do you make of the fans that are saying Kevin Stefanski wants him to fail? Cam Newton went on TV today and says, nope, Kevin Stefanski wants this guy to fail. That's why he's putting him in these situations.
It's ridiculous. It's such selective and nuanced thinking. I mean, it's just no coach in his right mind wants to fail. Kevin Stefanski going to get fired if he doesn't win games. And he put Shador Sanders in the role he is as the backup quarterback to start the year because he didn't trust him. And now he's got to trust him. You know, he's a backup quarterback and he's got to be like, okay, this is the guy that we're putting everything in. Dylan Gabriel was, 7 of 10 passing for 68 yards. Played the entire first half. Then he got concussion and then. Stefanski said after the game that if Gabriel clears the concussion protocol, he'll start against the Raiders. If he's not cleared, it'll be Sanders. And now it looks like it's going to be Sanders. So, We'll see what happens there. But
because there's a lot of arguments saying, well, Shador got no reps with the first team, all this kind of stuff. And that's the thing is when you're the backup, you don't get reps with the first team. That's called being a backup. So, like, you're right. There are no excuses this week. Shador's going to get the first team reps.
And he's playing a team that's not as good.
Right. And so Shador may come out and be awesome, and that'll be great. And we'll talk about it even more. He may come out and stink again because maybe he's just not very good. We don't know. But the fact that we're all making, you know, people are making excuses for him and saying, look, he needs to get first team reps throughout the week. How do you expect him to go out there? No, that's called being a backup quarterback in the NFL. That's being a pro in a professional league. Guess what? In basketball, same thing. You're not playing all the time in practice. You're not getting all the play calls. Yet you go in, you have to hit a three-pointer. Like, that's just kind of how it is.
Yeah.
In football, same thing. You're the backup quarterback. You don't get many reps, but you have to go out there and perform. He didn't, but he's going to get another opportunity. I think that's the good part about it.
Yeah, but you've got a lot of people who don't believe he got a fair shot. TJ Houshmandzadeh among them. Here he is.
From my assessment, y'all, they don't want a controversy. That's how they don't want a controversy, because we know what Flacco can do. Why is Flacco starting the game? We know what he can do. He led y'all to the playoffs the last time y'all let him play. So if you're trying to figure out who you going to play in case Flacco gets hurt, Dillon Gabriel, or Shador, you let them split the game. Tyler Huntley's getting cut tomorrow.
Yeah.
You let them battle it out. And so to me, it was like, wow, you put him in with guys that's going to be on the street tomorrow. They all getting cut, Shannon. Everybody should play with him cut tomorrow.
Yeah, but here you have, you know, that's in the preseason. You know, he needs more reps with the ones and the twos.
What is it about Shador that is so captivating? Is it a race thing?
I think it's race related. It's rooted in race. And it's rooted in a league that has had an issue with discrimination against players and the way that that
especially
owners and players have looked at sort of the plantation mentality of an NFL owner owning teams and just shut up and play, and the way that Colin Kaepernick, like it or not, justified or not, the way it was perceived, Colin Kaepernick's treatment in the league, there was the same sort of whispers about Shador when he came into the draft. People said the NFL told teams not to draft him. Eric Dickerson came out and said that, in August when training camp started.
And I'll tell you this much here, what I heard from someone that's in the NFL, that the NFL told other, don't draft him. Do not draft him. We're gonna make an example out of him. And this came from a very good source. And he said that, I won't say who, somebody called the Cleveland Browns and said, don't do that. Draft him.
Really?
Yep. Draft him. Don't do that. Because they weren't going to draft him either. They weren't going to draft him. Mm-mm. They were forced into drafting him because somebody made a call to them, said, and I say, when I say this is a NFL side source for sure, so this is not here. So look, one thing about it is, and I'll just say it, they don't like when guys have brains, especially black players, and that's mostly us with the brand, we kind of, some guys are flashy and all that kind of stuff. They don't like that.
I'll push back against Dickerson here. If you can play, the NFL doesn't care if you've been to prison. They don't care if you've killed dogs. They don't care if you have grabbed your significant other by her hair and dragged her into an elevator. They don't care. It has been proven time again. If you can play, the NFL teams will look the other way. I think we make it about race, but I think it's more about the perception that Shador was a lot of sizzle and no steak. And the NFL GMs went, he can't help us. And then a lot of people who were sitting around wanting to feed a narrative or an agenda said, oh, it's because he's black. Rex Ryan was watching Shador Sanders on the sideline this season. He's not the starter. And Rex Ryan says he doesn't like his body language. Listen to this.
Stefanski is one of an outstanding coach. All right. But why the hell isn't he putting Shador Sanders? We're all waiting to see the Shador Sanders be the guy or Gabriel, whatever. Something's missing. Something's missing with this kid. This kid talks. He runs his mouth like I could be a starting quarterback with his arms crossed like this. Get your ass in the front row and study and do all that. If I know, the whole league knows. Quit being an embarrassment that way. You got the talent to be the quarterback. You should be. You should be embarrassed that you're not the quarterback now.
So Rex Ryan saying this is between Shador's ears, that, and look, remember the comments? The reporter came up to Shador, asked him, you know, about being a backup and how do you feel about, you know, are you supportive of your team and Schroeder made the comment. And then he got criticized for what he said. And then the next time he basically refused to talk. He mimed. You know, I think he thinks he's being funny. I think he thinks he's smarter than everybody in the room. I think there's a problem with that and the attitude involved with that. And I think that he's not good enough for NFL GMs and NFL coaches to want to deal with it. I think that's what happened on draft day. It was more like, is the juice worth the squeeze? It's just not. I don't think it had to do with race, but people who want to engage in the race baiting and the conversations about race and who have seen what clearly looks like discrimination and other cases in the NFL, there are cases of discrimination. Let's not dance around that. There are cases where players have been discriminated against, but I don't think this is one of them. I think this is a meritocracy, the NFL. And I think if Shadur could really play, we would have seen a lot of Shadur already.
I agree with you on that one because there are lots of instances. Bill Polian told Lamar Jackson he should be a receiver. And, I mean, go look at Lamar Jackson's been doing at quarterback. I think Bill Polian was wrong on that one. So, yes, there are instances, but I think with the Shadur case, and the problem is I don't know that we're ever going to get an answer if Shadur can play because he's in Cleveland. Like, he is going to have to get out of Cleveland, but what team is going to want to take a risk of, you know, sending a seventh round draft pick or whatever to get Shadur and just know that there's going to be so much media hype around it? I mean, as soon as Shadur came in, John, you knew what ESPN was leading with. It was Shadur Sanders. Like, that's what it was going to be no matter what he did. And that, I think, it's almost on the Tim Tebow level hype of no matter what he did, they're going to talk about it. Shadur is a backup right now, and that's great. He could develop into a starting quarterback if his name was Shadur Vaughn. But since it's Shadur Sanders, he's Coach Prime's kid, he's going to have the spotlight on him, which I think is unfair, but that's just kind of what it is. ESPN and these TV markets are going to roll with it, and I just want to see if he can play, but I'm afraid we're never going to ever get that opportunity because he's never getting a fair chance of, like, just letting him focus
on
the
What do you mean by fair chance?
Like, he's not going to be able to just focus on football because the spotlight is going to be on him.
But who did that? Who did that? You know, did the NFL team say, hey, you guys, let's pay more attention to this? I think that came out of the experience at Colorado. And right. I can say this, like, I just this last weekend, I'm in San Diego, right? I'm around Sean Lewis. Sean Lewis's family is there. San Diego State is loving that Sean Lewis is there. And some of the scuttlebutt around Sean Lewis's time at Colorado is that it was so distracting to be calling plays for an offense that had Shadur Sanders in it. And, you know, the offense couldn't quite be what it was supposed to be because, you know, the directive was coming down from top down that Shadur needed to get numbers and you couldn't take guys out of the game. And I think we're seeing a very different approach at San Diego State. I kind of wonder if Sean Lewis ran for the hills, not because he wanted to be a head coach again, but because he was like, I need to get as far away from the circus atmosphere in Boulder as I possibly can get.
I don't think you're wrong. And I think the fact that Sean Lewis got a job at San Diego State, which seemed like the next day he left Colorado, is
gonzo.
Like,
yeah.
He was gone and then right away getting a high, you know, a pretty good job at San Diego State. Like, I think that shows what he can do as a head coach. And you're right, like with Shadur, my problem with it, John, is that we shouldn't care that Shadur Sanders went 4-for-16. Like, it was a rookie in his debut coming off the bench. We shouldn't expect him to be good, but we have to care about it because Shadur Sanders, and that's what I mean by he's not getting a fair chance. Is like, if it was anybody else, nobody would care, but it's Shadur Sanders, so we all supposedly need to care.
I heard a story in San Diego about a game that Colorado was playing in Sean Lewis's last season, calling the plays there. It was a Friday night. They're going through the walkthrough. Sean Lewis will not confirm this. I didn't write it, but I think I'm comfortable enough to tell the story here. An assistant coach on that Colorado team told me that Coach Prime came into the Friday night coaches meeting and listened to the game plan. This is what we're planning to do. This is how we're going to attack the opposition. I kind of think it was the Oregon State game. Based on the information that was given to me, I'm just educated guessing that it was the Oregon State game that Oregon State won at Boulder. And Coach Prime came into the meeting on the night before the game and said, no, this is not the game plan. I want a different game plan. And Sean Lewis said, everything's installed. Like, the terminology's in, the packages are in, this is what we're running. And Coach Prime overruled him and said, no, we're going a different direction. You may remember for that game, Sean Lewis did not end up calling the plays for that game. I think it was the Oregon State game late in that season that he basically lost his play calling abilities after that game. I think there was a dispute on Friday night before a Saturday game in which Oregon State and Colorado were playing, and Deion Sanders said, "No, that's not the game plan. We're going with a different game plan." And there you go. That's how you end up as the former coordinator at Colorado.
Do you think Shedeur Sanders is like the quote-unquote franchise quarterback for any team in his future?
No, but look, if you put him in a dream scenario, and I think he can play. But I also think he's going to be highly susceptible to the environment around him being just right. I think if you put him in Kyle Shanahan's offense, like with the 49ers, with George Kittle around and a good group of receivers, and there's just an energy there that is very offensive-minded and very much about what that offense can do, I think he would be good in that offense. But I think if you put him in a lot of offenses in the NFL and you just turn him loose, I think he's more of a system guy if he will adhere to a system. I think he's got enough arm. I think he's got enough athleticism. I think he's got some moxie to him. I like his game, but you remember everything at Colorado was tailored for him. It was about him, and it was about Travis Hunter. It was about making them shine. And that's why I think that Friday night game plan didn't fly. It wasn't about those two guys. Remember, Oregon State had trouble stopping the run that season. And I think where he gets in trouble is when it's not about him and it's not about his success and he's not set up. And that's going to be most NFL locker rooms. And that's going to be the Cleveland Browns. It's not going to be about Shedeur Sanders in Cleveland.
That's the hardest thing for a professional athlete to do, John, is adjust their game to the bigger levels because they've done it a certain way their entire lives. Yeah. And to go from being the superstar guy that is catering around your offense to being the backup.
With dad as a coach.
Right. And to adjust to a different thing is so hard to do. I know it sounds so easy because, you know, people love to say, well, if I was a professional athlete, I'd do whatever. Well, yeah, that's because you're not a professional athlete. You weren't born one way to do it. It's hard to adjust. And so I think it's hard for Shedeur to adjust going into any type of locker room, not being the man. I'm with you, though. I wish he could go to a 49ers or the Rams and Sean McVay or somebody, you know, that can coach up those quarterbacks, let him sit and learn a little bit. A Kevin O'Connell in Minnesota. Like, I would love to see it because I think he does have skills to be a quarterback, but I'm afraid we probably never will see it.
Is Brock Purdy worth $50 million? No. But can Brock Purdy be a star in that offense? Yes, because Brock Purdy will play within the system. I think Shedeur, if he would play within the system, a place like San Francisco, he'd be a star. He'd be great, and there'd be a lot of talk about, oh, he could be so much better, but down deep, we'd all know he's benefiting from that system. But he's not. Right now in Cleveland, he's not anywhere near that position, and I think it's going to be really rough to watch the next couple of weeks. Leave it here. Get the BFT.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
On the plane leaving San Diego on Sunday morning, take an early flight out, might not have been the best choice. And I had a lot of respect for pilots, and I got a lot of respect for the flight crews that work on airplanes. I couldn't deal with, you know, 120 people, 170 people, 150 people, 50 people. I couldn't deal with 50 people in a encapsulated compartment and deal with the wants and needs and personalities of all those people on the plane. And it's still a miraculous thing to me that someone can, you know, drive a plane down a runway, lift it off into the air, and the thing actually flies. Like, the physics of it, just I marvel at it. But one of the things that I find amusing, and maybe it's because I have a microphone in front of me 15 hours a week, one of the things I find amazing is when the pilot or the flight attendant takes over the microphone on the plane. And the pilot, before we departed, and granted, I was up late after the San Diego State-Boise State game, writing, working, barely got any sleep, head to the airport at like 5 o'clock in the morning. Then I'm looking forward to sleeping on this plane. And so when I get into the plane, I get buckled in, and I kind of exhale into my seat. I am expecting to maybe be able to sleep. And the pilot interrupted that because he wanted to do some stand-up comedy at 7 o'clock in the morning. He said, tell me if you think this is funny, at 7 o'clock in the morning. He said, you know, welcome to flight, I'm going to make this up, 277 on Alaska Airlines, traveling from San Diego, home of the Padres. And he paused, and then he said, there was silence. He said, no Padres fans, huh? Well, we're heading into Portland, where the temperature today is in the 50s and a little rainy. And we'll be leaving San Diego, home of the Padres. And a couple people woohoo, clapped in the back of the plane. He said, okay, we got two Padres fans now. And he said, we'll be departing here off of runway 12. And we're going to have an on-time departure. Flight time is 2 hours and 11 minutes. And we will be leaving San Diego, home of the Padres, home of the San Diego Padres. And now about a third of the plane was, yeah, Padres. And we'll be heading into Portland. And he said, I am your captain. And he gave his name. And he said, and I am a fan of the two-time defending world champion Los Angeles Dodgers. And then he dropped the mic and disappeared into the cockpit. It got some laughs because he set us up. Like he was a Padres fan. He was a Padres guy. Hey, how about the Padres? How about the Padres? And then hammered people with the Dodgers. And, he thought it was funny. Somebody told him it was funny. I don't mind him for trying. It's hard to do comedy. The stand-up comedians who listen to the show can attest to that. It's the hardest thing in the world to do comedy. But at 7 o'clock in the morning, Stephen, I'm not quite in the mood for that bit. And I kind of went, man, I could have done without that 2 minutes that he just spent doing that to me. And then the flight attendant, the lead flight attendant who went through all of the, you know, is your seatbelt fastened and all that stuff. She was a little off-putting too, because she was trying to be funny too. And I thought to myself, God, I was like, guys, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't even seven. It's like 6:40 in the morning. Can we hold this till maybe later in the flight? That would be a thing. I don't know. What do you make of that? Is the bit funny or no?
Yeah, it's a good bit. It's a good bit. But like you said, that early in the morning, I'm not ready for any bit. So I don't know that I would enjoy it that early in the morning, but I think they got, you know, he has a little thing going where he wants to make fun of the Padres, and he's a Dodger fan. So I think that's great because they hate each other
down there.
There's a big rivalry between those two teams.
I felt kind of bad as a Giants fan because I feel like the Padres-Dodgers rivalry has replaced the Giants-Dodgers rivalry in the minds of Dodger fans. It's a Southern California thing. And then the flight attendant was doing a thing where she was going to memorize everybody's name on the plane. So she was going seat by seat, looking at her roster, saying your name and looking at you. And then as I'm getting off the plane, she literally looked at me and said, have a good day, John. I thought, you're working too hard, lady. Like, you know, I'm just here to sleep. I was hoping to get some rest on this plane. You're working too hard trying to do a magic trick, trying to memorize, do a little team building at 20,000 feet. A little too much for me. But yeah, but the Padres fans and the Dodgers fans, the big takeaway, they don't like each other. That is a real rivalry that is good for the Padres, and it's good for the Dodgers probably in Major League Baseball. I wonder if Portland and Seattle could get something going like that if there ever was a Major League Baseball team in Portland. The 5 at 5 is coming up top of the hour. Steven's got the stories. We'll do it next.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Been a fun show today. One of my stand-up comedian friends just texted me. He's listening to the show. He said 7 a.m. is never the time for a crowd work bit. So thank you for that. Thank you for that very much. Appreciate that. By the way, at johncanzano.com today, I had the Monday mailbag. And in the Monday mailbag, a reader expressed his frustration, his peeve at how people pronounce certain words. And I try not to be that guy, but there are some, I do have some weaknesses in my game. This person said, I can't believe how people pronounce the number between 10 and 12. How do you say the number between 10 and 12, Steven?
11?
11 is right. He doesn't like when people say 11.
A lot of people say 11.
11. 11. 11. 11. 11. Yeah. Difference between 11 and 11. And I used to cover a college football coach who would say frustrated when he meant frustrated. I didn't like it, but I let it slide because I don't want to be that guy. Dennis Erickson always said Washington instead of Washington. Oh, we all know Jerry DiNardo, who struggled with the pronunciation of Oregon.
Oregon bothers me, actually.
It does?
As an Oregonian, yeah. When people say Oregon, like Oregon, like that, it actually does bother me.
It is it's a peeve of yours?
Yeah.
Why does it bother you? Is it because you think they haven't taken the time to figure it out?
Yeah, just like when people say Gonzaga. Like, no, it's Gonzaga. I don't know. I just feel like it's not that hard of a word to pronounce. And so when you mess it up, It bothers me.
I tell people it's not a piano. It's an organ. It's easier than having like the, because they get that Oregon in there. Oregon. I have a problem. I'm not perfect. I will say espresso instead of espresso. Hmm. I am sure that the baristas cannot stand that when they hear me do that.
Well, that caller called me out for Jaguars the other day, so.
Yeah, I did. Remember when I had the Appalachian State thing?
Appalachian, you jerk.
George W. Bush, president, he had a problem with nuclear instead of nuclear. Nuclear, he would say. Nuclear instead of nuclear. I had that same problem. So I could have been president, you know. But the problem is he actually had control of the nuclear arsenal.
Like, if you're in control, you should know how to say it, right?
He would say nuclear. And I also would say nuclear. But my friend, the comedian, the reason I bring this up, because it was in our text exchange, our last text exchange was a word that he struggles with. The word is crouton. Crouton. That you put on a salad? It's a crouton. He says it with an unnaturally long pause. Crouton. And it sounds intentional, but it's not, because he's just trying to go slow.
Sounds like a bit.
Like Gary Crouton? You know? I don't know. Anyway, do you have a peeve? Like, besides that, you say the Oregon bothers you?
The Oregon one bothers me, because it's a state in the United States. Like, you should know how to pronounce the states.
I don't know, though. When I came to the state, I was like, Lake Oswego gave me some trouble.
The Willamette?
Yeah. And the street names? Is it Gleason or Glisson? Is it Cooch or Couch? There's some things going on that are a little squirrely in the Portland metropolitan area. Keeping it weird. All right, we're going to do the 5 at 5. Speaking of weird, 5 biggest stories. Let's go.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
All right, John. Hold on here. I was answering a phone call there. I'm back, though. Well, we are back. Okay, number 1. College Game Day has announced that they will be coming to the University of Oregon. Back to Eugene for the second time. Oregon will be taking on USC. It's the only ranked-on-ranked matchup this year, or this week, I should say. But it made me look at some of the betting lines for this game. Of course, right now, BetOnline has Oregon as an early 10-point favorite. But I looked at the playoff odds, John. This is the crazy part. Oregon is minus 300 to make the playoff, while USC is plus 400. So, I mean, I wonder if that means that they're kind of saying, look, they can lose this game and they can get in, or they really need to win. But kind of interesting, the playoff odds there. But Oregon, they'll be back in College Game Day down in Eugene.
I think Oregon is going to beat USC on Saturday. I also think it's a must-win for the Ducks if you don't want to have a little knot in your stomach on the morning where the final college football playoff rankings come out. You have to leave no doubt, in a two-loss Oregon team with these SEC pundits and honks floating around out there, a two-loss Oregon team becomes a little problematic, especially if it's another loss like the Indiana loss. You know, if you lose to USC and it's not a good look, it's going to cause you some problems if you're the Ducks. It's why Oregon needs to play well. It's why a lot of people are saying it's a playoff game. I do think it's a playoff game. Oregon wins this game and beats Washington. There's no doubt about it. They're in the playoff, and that's how you have to think.
Number 2.
Well, I want to ask you a question for number two, John. Do you think Matthew Stafford is a Hall of Fame quarterback?
I don't. I don't see Stafford. And maybe I'm comparing him to Dan Marino and Joe Montana and Patrick Mahomes. But I know on paper his numbers are going to be fantastic.
And he's got a Super Bowl. The Rams just beat the Seahawks yesterday 21-19. Moves the Rams to 8-2 in the season. But it also, I asked you that for Matthew Stafford, because now his all-time career record is now finally above 500.
Yeah.
Think about how many years Matthew Stafford's played. He was number one overall pick, went way back in the day from Georgia. Of course, he played for the Lions for forever, so his record was never very good. He was 74-90-1 with the Lions, and then he got traded to the Rams where he's 42-25. But that win yesterday, I just thought it was amazing that, such a big game in the NFC West. But with the win, Matthew Stafford now has an all-time record above 500, and I think he's a Hall of Famer. So why it's interesting to me. He's like 37 or whatever, and he's been in the league for, 17 years. He's finally above 500. Just seems crazy to me. But
he's a good quarterback. Yeah. He's a good quarterback, and he has a Super Bowl ring. But I don't necessarily believe it's the Hall of Good. And I think if Dak Prescott wins a Super Bowl or Jared Goff wins a Super Bowl, do you suddenly go, they're Hall of Famers too?
It's like, Eli, just because Eli has two, but he wasn't, Stafford's way better than Eli Manning.
If Stafford doesn't have a ring, is he remotely close to the discussion?
Probably not.
So, I think Eli, does a lot for him. Two rings, two Super Bowl MVPs, top 10 in the metrics. I look at Stafford and I think, I don't want to punish him for the Lions being incompetent. I think I am. But
that's kind of the point of the number two, is that the Lions are so bad that he's finally 500.
What he does this year, he goes and wins another Super Bowl. Yeah, that helps his case, but I don't think he's a no-brainer. But we'll see. Can he be an MVP? Can he make a deep run into the playoffs? And does that seal it for him?
Number three.
Well, it just became official a couple minutes ago, but Virginia Tech has officially hired James Franklin to be their next head coach. Of course, Franklin was fired by Penn State, but he had spent 12 seasons at Penn State. Penn State never finished below 500 except for once. That was during the COVID 2020 year, but Penn State had won 10 games the last 3 years each. And James Franklin will be headed to Virginia Tech. And other coaching news, Ole Miss has told Lane Kiffin he needs to decide before the November 28th Egg Bowl whether he's staying at Ole Miss or taking the Florida LSU job. And there are rumors that if he takes that job, they will just kick him out right away and he will not coach in the playoffs. So he may leave, Lane Kiffin, but James Franklin officially at Virginia Tech.
Yeah, Lane Kiffin's going to find a way to make that messy. Everything else has been messy in his tenure. Are we on three?
Four.
Four, that's right. Moving on.
Number four.
Do you think he takes it or do you think he stays? I think he leaves.
I think he takes it.
Wait, you think he's leaving Ole Miss or staying?
Yeah, no, I think he leaves Ole Miss and goes to LSU.
I agree. He's taking that job.
Yeah. Spurs center Victor Wembanyama has been awesome this year. 26 points, 13 rebounds, 4 assists, 3.5 blocks. But he will be sidelined for a few weeks due to a left calf strain. Now, the Spurs are supposedly erring on the side of caution because of this injury, but he'll be reevaluated in 2 to 3 weeks. Spurs are 9-4 in the young season. They look really good. They're a young team. Wemby's been the MVP level. Man, I hope the injuries aren't a problem for this guy. He's so big. He's so lengthy, but he's had some injury concerns, and now he'll be out for at least 2 to 3 weeks.
Wemby, big guy. People in Portland not surprised by a big guy having some issues. I think that'll be the challenge for his career. It's about staying healthy when you're that big. He's got long levers and, big feet. You got to be careful with him.
Number five.
Then we're heading out because of Monday Night Football, Cowboys, Raiders in Vegas. But more importantly, Ducks, Beavers, Civil War basketball, 7 p.m. tip-off on FS1. Both teams 3-0. Oregon 14.5-point favorites. Jackson Shellstad healthy and back for the Ducks. Beavs have won their three games by a combined 8 points all at home. So should be an interesting game between these two teams.
I love it. And this part of the magic of the NFL. It's not the greatest matchup. These aren't the greatest teams. These are not Super Bowl contenders. But people will tune in. It'll get a nice number. It's Monday Night Football. Why is that, Stephen? Why do we love the NFL so much?
Gambling.
I don't think it's gambling. I think
fantasy gambling. Why else would you watch Cowboys Raiders? There's no reason.
That's part of it. I think people will tune in. My 9-year-old daughter wants to watch it. My 11-year-old wants to watch
it. She's gambling.
Yeah. We'll see about that.